I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. We call it An American Conversation with Global Attitude. This one is with the orchestral conductor George Matthew, who seems to show up at Carnegie Hall every year about this time in mid-January with an unusual concert for a vast global purpose. 3 years ago, it was Beethoven's Ninth Symphony to benefit the earthquake-shattered people of Kashmir, a concert that brought Indians and Pakistanis and Beethoven all together. 2 years ago, it was Verdi's Requiem for the people of Darfur in the Sudan. On Monday, January 12th, a week and a day before the Obama inauguration in Washington, George Matthew will be leading his own orchestra of stars in Mahler's Third Symphony to benefit the children of AIDS. George Matthew, your project fascinates me. My sense from afar is that you're developing some sort of longer story here about the many meanings of music and the outer dimensions of art. But you tell us, what in the world are you up to?
I'm just learning to tell myself what in the world I'm up to, Chris. Since we first started talking about this, this project has grown both in its scope and its conception. We started off, as you described, as concerts for humanitarian purposes, people affected by natural disasters, people affected by political conflict, and now a major global health crisis. But it may be that the humanitarian aspect, the fundraising aspect, the raising of public awareness for these causes, may be the very fortuitous surface by which we bring music to bear as a really potent civic force. Hmm. There is so much in ensemble music, and especially in symphonic music, because it requires that we come together as a community. On stage first, I mean, we're talking about an orchestra of 100 people, and in these pieces, a choir of about as many, so all these concerts have had over 200 people on stage, and that is a kind of community dynamic which could stand as a wonderful metaphor and really an ideal for what it is that we are striving to do in these opening days of the 21st century after all the mayhem of the last few centuries.
Music is a civic force. I want you to unpack that, George. But first, would you just explain who is in your orchestra, who's in your chorus? Who are we?
We are this concert, Mahler for the Children of AIDS, the we are musicians, principal artists, some of them, great chamber music artists, some of them, from... at last count, 42 of the world's great orchestras and some ensembles.
But who puts them together? How does this happen?
It usually happens with one conversation, Chris. It starts with my talking to one in the last three concerts. It's always happened with my talking to a member of the one of the players from the New York Philharmonic. More often than not, that is our concertmaster Glenn Dichterow, who is an enlightened human being himself, and he says, "Oh, this is such a wonderful thing. Let's talk to the others or his colleagues." In this particular instance, we had in the past concerts the principal trombone Joseph Alessi, who's one of the legendary characters of his instrument. Was very helpful in gathering his colleagues for the other two concerts, but he wasn't able to play. And he said, "Oh, I wish you'd do something when I could do it." I said, "Oh, I'm thinking about doing Mahler Third." He said, "Oh, I'll play. Tell me when." And so he, you know, I went to Glenn after that, Mr. Dichterow, and I said, "Listen, Joe wants to do this." And he said, "Oh, wonderful. Let's find a date." And the next thing, I went to Carnegie Hall, we found a date that worked, and then it was a question of just rounding up the others. And we have, at the last count, I think we have 15 musicians, several of them principal players from the New York Philharmonic, I think 12 or 13 from the Metropolitan Opera, half a dozen from the Philadelphia Orchestra, several from the Orchestra St. Luke's, and then others from the Minnesota Orchestra, the Emerson String Quartet, the Hamburg Chamber Orchestra, the Singapore Symphony, the New Zealand Youth Orchestra, the Cape Philharmonic of South Africa.
Oh, word.
And an important aspect of this is that not only is it these great artists coming together from diverse ensembles and playing together, sometimes for the first time since they were young and in conservatory together, but there is also the aspect of some of their protégés and young musicians, some of them students, some of them not still students, who are coming together to play and share this experience of uplifting humanity, if you will, with their teachers, with the people who gave them their way with their instruments.
George, come back to the business of music as a civic force. Or you could also think of it as putting civic force to music, so to speak. But what is this connection you're making between Beethoven's Ode to Joy in Kashmir, or Verdi in Darfur, or in this case, Gustav Mahler and AIDS?
Well, there are two aspects. On the surface of it, there is the notion that distinguishes, I like to think, these concerts from all the other benefit concerts and charity concerts, whether classical or otherwise, around the world. And that is that the mission is somehow embedded and grows out of the musical material.
I'm listening to Mahler 3, and I'm wondering, where do you hear him addressing this horrendous picture of orphans of a world epidemic?
Well, there is a place in the beginning of the fourth movement. Now, the piece is written around 1895, 1896. And around that time, when you get to the fourth movement of a symphony, people are expecting a big final movement, a big finale, a big denouement, you know, a gathering together of the forces and a celebration or climax or something. And instead, you have this very bare, barren moonscape of music. And it's just the cellos and basses mumbling, and they start off with sort of a rumble or a sigh, as the case may be. And onto that sort of moonscape comes a single woman, a human being, and she opens her mouth and sings, which is sort of the last thing you expect to hear in a symphony, even in 1895. And what she says is, in German, she says, O Mensch, gib acht, give heed, O man. And the gender is very clear. O man, not O mankind, O ye of the Y chromosome, give heed, pay attention, or simply put, perhaps, shut up and listen. And this music continues in this vein, and then she moves into the space of the Also sprach Zarathustra, from which this is, thus spake Zarathustra, from which this is drawn, and explores a bit of the nature of sorrow and the nature of joy and the nature of pleasure, which are those things that men are very interested in, and the pursuit of happiness, as it were. And then she stops and says, no, hang on a moment, listen. And that is the spirit in which the movement dies away. And this is this interruption of our expectation as listeners in Mahler's time and today. And there is silence that comes. And in that silence, suddenly we hear, beginning of the next movement, the voices of children. What they're saying is bim, bum, bim, bum. They're saying essentially the German equivalent of ding-dong. They're saying nothing at all. It's almost as though there's a hint that these are voices that are too young. These are creatures too young to speak words even. That's how vulnerable they are. And then the women's chorus comes in, and we hear the words of the medieval German song, the Wunderhorn song, that that is also titled the Poor Children's Begging Song. And it's about, we hear the sentiments of Peter, St. Peter standing outside the gate of heaven saying, I am crying, weeping and saying, I have sinned, I have fallen short of the Ten Commandments, I'm so guilty, I'm so unworthy, I don't. And, you know, the voice of God says, why are you crying? Don't cry. All you have to do is love. And, of course, this is all being written by Mahler 100 years before anybody knew anything about HIV or AIDS, by the authors of the Wunderhorn song centuries before. So how do we now say this is about this epidemic or AIDS, orphans, or any of it? It isn't. It is about resonances. The music touches our lives because of the resonances that the archetypes of human experience share. Mahler, like all the great composers before and after him, draws upon the great pillars, the archetypes, the central experiences of human experience, the likes of which you and I know so well. And out of that come these resonances. Guilt is something we all know something about. Loneliness is something we all know something about. You know, women not being afforded pride of place is something we all know something about, most recently from this presidential election. And those resonances, I believe, not only can be harvested, but must be harvested to yield, to speak to our time and place. Mm. We could say we've never been in a more needy time and place than our own. As a human species, as a society, as individuals, we are at war with each other. We are at we're falling apart in our creation of an economic system. We are seeing thousands and millions of our own sort of shriveling away, while others don't know what to do with their resources and their wealth. And in this time, we have unlimited, it seems, resources to spread the word, to communicate. I'm sitting here in New York talking to you in Rhode Island. And it is really our responsibility, our capacity to respond, to harvest meaning, to harvest resonance with the great works of art and say, these people are prophets, these great artists, whether it's Milton or Shakespeare or Hermann Broch or you know, Tagore, and what do they have to say to us? And if we listen carefully, we can hear the prophetic nature of their utterance. You had Amitav Ghosh the other day. I mean, the man is a prophet. And
George, this is fascinating. I love to hear you talk about music, but I have two questions. Do all conductors think about these overtones of their work? And how did you come to this kind of approach?
Well, I've had several wonderful musical parents and mentors in my life who were very, very careful and probing thinkers, one of whom I spent just a few days with 20 years ago at Tanglewood, was Leonard Bernstein. And for him, it was never enough to render the music perfectly. It was never enough for a musician's pursuit to be the pursuit of the Olympic athlete, of playing the notes accurately, of lining everything up, of playing them in tune. You had to invest them with a kind of life force that meant that they had to connect with the situation of the players, with the situation of the musicians, with the situation of the audience, with the situation of the world outside. And I think, you know, he confessed, I think at that time, if I remember right, that he drew some of this from his own mentor, Dimitri Mitropoulos, who was his predecessor, the music director of the New York Philharmonic, and a great mystic and a very, very powerful intellect. Mm. But, you know, we have, if you listen carefully, we have among the intellectuals, both in music and beyond, the notion that, putting out the notion that the text in music, in literature, you know, once it is released by the author, has the ability to stand as a living entity with whom we as performers, as critics, as listeners, as readers, can enter into a kind of mystical conversation. And then the text speaks to us. Now, in order to enter into conversation, you have to know how to speak the language. You have to know what it says. So part of it is just a certain amount of training and literacy. But part of it is really sort of bearing yourself and entering into a kind of sacred communion with the text, and then it talks.
The players who accepted your invitation obviously must yearn to do it that way. I wonder how many performers, how many orchestras out there are giving us music in this spirit?
Well, it's a tricky thing. You know, in this day and age, you know, we live in a time when music has been, classical music and many other kinds of music, have been sort of rendered as Olympic sport. You know, it's tremendously competitive. The technical level is very high, and it takes a lot of human energy and resource to keep the body, the calisthenic aspect of all of this, up to par. I mean, you cannot be technically 99.9% and get through the first round of an audition for a second violin spot with a Boston Symphony. The competition begins at 100% and then some. Mm. And which means that a huge amount of the resources of the young musicians are spent sort of on the athletic aspects of music, on playing things accurately, on having perfect muscle control and body control and pitch and rhythm and all those things, and to actually, you know, work on, to actively go outside music and look at the interdisciplinary aspects of it is a challenge and an additional activity, which I'm thrilled to say a great many young artists and not so young artists are very, very serious practitioners of. I mean, you only need to talk to Yo-Yo Ma or our friend Andrew Rangel, whom you had on the show the other day, or even somebody like a Daniel Barenboim, to know that these people are very, very serious observers and readers and partakers, as it were, of the world situation. And they bring that to bear in their interaction with the music. Eugene Drucker, the person who is sitting on the second chair of the first violin section with Glenn Dichterow, our concertmaster, has just written a novel, a beautiful novel called The Savior, which relates, has resonances with his own father's experiences as a Jewish artist in Germany in during the Hitler time. And, you know, that is something that, and he also has the ability to play the Bach Chaconne with the kind of magic that the protagonist of his novel does. So this does happen. It doesn't happen as much as we would like, say, in the big ensembles, because there is so much to do with actually putting the thing together. It's a struggle for me to, you know, put everything together, get the administrative and fundraising bits and all going, and then have the marbles to actually keep the pulse absolutely ragingly fierce in the first movement, for instance. That takes a lot of energy.
George, it's fascinating to hear you talk about music. You make us listen better to the music, and you also make us listen deeper for its implications.
Oh, Chris, since you've mentioned make us listen, the humanitarian aspect, the mission even as manifest by the music, is really important, as we described. But still, it is not the deep magic, as C.S. Lewis would say in the Narnia books. The deep magic comes from the play, from what your earlier guest, Mr. Barenboim, said about his East-West Divan Orchestra. The deep magic is that when musicians come together to play music in an ensemble, in an orchestra, in a string quartet, they are required to do, to engage the highest form of musical activity, and that is of listening. And that is of listening with a view that the person sitting next to you who is playing music that may contrast or even conflict with what you're doing has to be given a right of way in your own consciousness. That the narrative of the other is at least as important, if not more important, than your own narrative. That somehow we transcend the self in order to realize our potential as human beings. Wilhelm Furtwängler, the conductor of the Berlin Philharmonic in the middle of the century, has this mysterious diary entry, I think, and he wrote, the West, Christ, Europe, the intensification of instinct and self. And then across the page from it, he wrote, the East, India, Buddha, the overcoming of instinct, self. And I like to think that these two are not necessarily conflicting values, but complementary values that ensemble music actually embraces. But, you know, I had this incredible experience in India a few months ago, where I conducted a young school orchestra. They were all playing violins and cellos, and reading a Mozart symphony, which had all sorts of other things, and they were just determined to do this. So the oboe parts were played by the violins, and playing by the violins. They had only one cello to play the cello part. And these young people were unschooled a little bit, but we got to the point where I said, listen, hold it. Let's stop for a moment. You guys in the back, do you know each other's names? Let's just get to know each other a little bit. So they introduced each other. It turned out they had never... they'd been playing for 6 months, and they didn't know each other's names. And then I said, well, now, you've got to breathe together, which means you've got to know when the other person is breathing. Will you play the phrase looking at each other? Will you play the phrase understanding where the other person's breath is coming from? Oh, okay. So they did. And this went on. And I said, okay, now can you understand where the breath is coming from the person sitting here at the front of the stand, front of the second violins? And so this went on. Finally, in about 45 minutes, I mean, this was not a huge time-consuming thing. In about 45 minutes, the whole orchestra not only knew everybody's names, but they were living and breathing with each other. And they knew that, oh, so-and-so has a slightly bummed A string, and so be careful. If we're going to be in tune with that, we've got to all play a little bit flat. Or if so-and-so has a little bit of difficulty on, you know, with in high position. So we've got to listen a little bit more carefully to that, which means they were going into the space of the other person, every single one of them. And they were saying, oh, you know, we have to care about this person's particular aspect or idiosyncrasy or just slight weirdness, and we have to meet that. And at the end of it, they were all bowing and playing in ferociously in tune. And they sounded like a very respectable professional orchestra, as you might find anywhere in the Western world. And this had been 45 minutes, and I stopped and I said, folks, you have to know that what you have just done is become a community. You have just engaged each other in ways that none of you can walk away from. You have just connected as a community. And now stop for a moment and consider what would happen if the Karnataka state legislature started behaving this way. Consider what would happen if the Indian parliament started behaving this way. Consider what would happen if the United Nations Security Council or the House of Representatives of, God save us all, the United States Senate, started to behave this way. Or if the exchange between political candidates and between Republican and Democrat was with this kind of spirit. What would happen to public discourse. What would happen if the corporations began to talk this way to each other? What would happen if they began to talk this way within themselves and say, oh, I'm making $70 million and my employee is making $25,000 and is struggling. Well, how can I really engage that experience? And what does it do to me? And then what happens to both parties? Suddenly, you have the possibility of ensemble. And maybe it, in 2008, 3.5 million years after the monkey stood up upright and took a view, look around, maybe it's time. And maybe we as musicians can make this our contribution. Maybe this is the moment when we say, the art of playing music, when we expose it, to the people who, to the segment of the population that is biologically specialized to absorb this, namely the segment of the population under the age of 12, might have an impact. And maybe if we really made a stand for music education for our very young, with a view to what, say, is happening in Venezuela, or some of the other enlightened music education programs around the world, maybe we have a chance that the aberration of civic life that we just saw in the last 8 years will truly be a thing of the past. And these pained, hurt, deprived children will not grow up and come to haunt us all in their adulthood.
Could we learn to hear each other breathing? Could we learn to make music together? George Matthew, you're good for our ears. You're good for our spirits. Congratulations on what you're doing. Keep doing it. And let's hear you again on Open Source. Thank you, George Matthew.
You're very welcome, Chris. Always a pleasure.
Paul McCarthy and Sarah Archambault produced and edited this conversation with George Matthew. Put in your own two bits about music, about Mahler, about artists and the world health crisis, with your own comment on our website at radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.